Well, I'm very pleased indeed to welcome Professor Sushil Mittal, who's from James Madison University in the States, where he's Professor of Religion in the Department of Religion, I think. And you'll know him from his many publications. Particularly, you probably know him from The Hindu World, which is on our shelves somewhere. But he's also the author of Development and Change in India, Surprising Bedfellows, Hindus and Muslims in Medieval and Early Modern India, Religions of South Asia, An Introduction, and Studying Hinduism, Key Concepts and Methods. And he's the founding editor of our rival, the International Journal of Hindu Studies, which has been going for many, many years now. Mittal and I first met many years ago in the AAR, and I think we both had hair then, I think, if I remember.
Actually, you know what? We met much, much, much earlier.
Did we?
We met actually when I was an undergraduate.
Oh, really? Really?
Yeah, through email. Correspondence.
Oh, through correspondence. Right. Great, yes. And it's so, we've been planning your Shiv Dasani Fellowship now for some years, so yes. It's a real honour to have you here with us. Yes. And I'm very pleased indeed to welcome you to OCHS. And you're going to speak to us today on Hinduism and peace building. So, yes. Professor Mittal, over to you.
Thank you, Professor Kevin. You know, when I was planning that journal, International Journal of Hindu Studies, I wrote to you seeking your advice. And this is in... this was in... before... in 92. Mm. 92, 93. And then the journal came out 5 years later in 97.
Wow.
Yeah. Those were actually, I was an undergraduate at McGill University. Wow, that has, what, 15, 18, 19, 20, some,
yeah,
22
these
years.
Yeah.
Wow. Can we introduce ourselves?
Who's starting? Do I start?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, why not?
We
are so few.
Yeah, okay, I'm Shrikari. For those of you who don't know, I'm the intern at the office, so I'm working reception.
My name is Anthony, an MST student, study of religion.
My name is Vid, I'm also an MST study of religion.
Okay. I'm Anuradha, and I work here in the continuing education department.
My name is Sachi, I'm DPhil student here.
Pavlo, DPhil student.
DPhil.
Sam,
Deepan, and well, yes.
This is a big
Professor
car for
Gavin.
Oxford.
My lecture is mainly meant for undergraduates, so you may find it a little boring, but please bear with me. So what I'm going to do is first talk about what is Hinduism. Not necessarily define Hinduism, but what is Hinduism? And then that I lead that to talk about Hinduism and peace building, and then conclude with the concept of dharma. So what is Hinduism? There is so much diversity among people who think of themselves as Hindu, in such a variety of ways that they have preferred to live their lives, that it is impossible to present a typical Hindu who would make it really simple to learn about Hinduism. Instead, it is important to take into account many kinds of Hindus and many images. Imagine a red silk sari interwoven with gold threads, a homespun cotton dhoti, a designer suit and tie, an oval jet black stone besmeared with crimson powder, a shining gold deity image glittering with precious jewels, a 10-headed goddess waving a bloody sword and riding atop a tiger. A village woman carrying an earthen pot brimming with water atop her head. A well-to-do city wife, housewife, drawing water into a pink porcelain bathtub. A tribal elder bathing in a river. A young man wearing a cord looped over his left shoulder and draped down his right side. Another with divine names permanently inked into his skin. A naked mendicant covered only by ashes and his long matted hair. High castes, low castes, outcasts. Beggars, kings, and renunciants. 325 languages expressed in more than 2,000 dialects and 25 scripts. Such diversity, and all of it can have something to do with living as a Hindu. These images may help us to see why definitions of Hindus and Hinduism can seem so baffling. Hinduism is a complex set of interrelationships among many sorts of people, belief system, and practices, rather than a single, uniformly structured, bureaucratically organized, and centrally codified religion. A student who is an outsider to Hinduism is likely to think about it on the basis of a Christian or Muslim model of religion. Outsiders seem to have given Hinduism its name too. But naming of by outsiders has been typical of most major religions, including Christianity. Islam is an exception because it was a term revealed by Prophet Muhammad. No Hindu word corresponds exactly to the term religion. And whoever or whatever should be considered responsible for inventing Hinduism, which is how some contemporary or postmodern Western scholars refer to the question of its origins, is a matter of ongoing debate. Nevertheless, over a billion people prefer to call themselves Hindus presently, and another few more billion refer to them as Hindus. And most of us in the academia also continue to use the word Hinduism as a general term to denote a constellation of South Asian religious thought and activity that includes an incredible variety of expression and may range from simple beliefs of uneducated folk through elaborate rituals of a priestly intelligentsia to the transcendent meditations of an accomplished mystic. Hence, there is no point in arguing over the terminology, as scholars do in Western academia. Although many contrasting and in some instances competing, at times even conflicting, forms of belief and practice can be included within the category of Hinduism, in general, Hindus suppose that what is essential for one human being in a specific situation and at a particular stage in their development need not be appropriate for another. As a result, the extent of Hindu diversity, complexity, and variety makes a complete and closed capsule definition that would include all of the features that could be found within the range of things usually considered Hindu impossible to formulate. Therefore, what we call Hinduism is an interpretation of the currently available record of the multifaceted ways that hundreds of millions of human beings in the subcontinent of India from ancient times to the present have shaped their lives. In short, Hinduism, like Americanism, is a term that has been made to carry a variety of different meanings that range from the loftiest ideals to the lowliest forms of behavior. Like Americanism too, Hinduism is linked with a particular geographical place. From ancient times, Hindus made their home in South Asia on the subcontinent of India. And even today, Hindus who live elsewhere in the world tend to look to India for models of religious life and for the sources of their spiritual traditions. Hinduism is not unique, but it is unusual among the world's major religions in having neither an identified founder nor a single defining creed, neither a central authority nor a fixed pantheon, neither a universally accepted scripture nor a seamless system of beliefs. Since the model of neither Muslim nor Christian religion fits it, modern scholars repeatedly comment on the difference of Hinduism. Wilfred Cantwell Smith has done so in a way that has been particularly influential. I quote him. He says, "Many Christians and many Muslims have come to believe that there is one true Christianity and one true Islam. Hindus, on the other hand, have glorified in diversity. One of their basic and persistent affirmations has been that there are as many aspects of the truth as there are persons to perceive it." In other words, there are as many Hinduisms as there are Hindus. In other words, every Hindu appropriates Hinduism in his or her own way, and in a way somewhat different from the way it is appropriated by another. Organizationally, if not theologically, Hinduism is more similar to Judaism than to either Islam or Christianity. As Jacob Neusner has remarked, all we seem to have is a host of differing Judaisms all talking with each other. Academic research has shown again and again, however, that the popular impression that there is a unified, uniform, and unanimous Christian or Muslim religion is mistaken when viewed in light of the evidence of history. The complex variations among the actual lives of Christians or Muslims, and the contemporary discussions about how to interpret the sources of those religions that currently involve their own scholars, spiritual leaders, and scriptural commentaries. So Hinduism is multifaceted, as well as characterized by diversity. It is a category that encompasses religion, philosophy, and interrelated ways of life that comprise a complete civilization. So Hinduism is multifaceted as well as characterized by diversity. It is a category that encompasses religion, philosophy, and interrelated ways of life that comprise a complete civilization. Leaders in the Hindu Renaissance of the 19th and 20th centuries proposed that Hinduism could serve the world as an example of a universal framework for religious and spiritual pluralism. Yet, no concise, substantive definition of Hinduism has proven to be wholly satisfactory, in part because the various students of Hinduism, including Hindus themselves, tend to place their emphasis on different aspects of the whole. Despite its daunting variety, ever since the 19th century, influential Hindus have asserted the identity and unity of Hinduism in a successful effort to establish it as a major world religion with the same status as Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. The question that inevitably must be asked, of course, is whether any key features in the comprehensive phenomenon known as Hinduism can be identified. And if so, whether they would be evident only to Hindu insiders or whether non-Hindu outsiders would recognize them too. There are a few that may be considered characteristic features, such as the authority of the Ved or the revealed scriptures. Dharma, code of conduct, moksha, seeking of liberation, samsara, the cosmic process of beings dying and being reborn, karma, which states that actions produce consequences commensurate with their moral quality, jeev, the individual, atman and brahman, the innermost self and ultimate reality, avidya, maya, ignorance, yogas, paths to liberation or to brahman, the ultimate reality, varna, social organization, ashram, stages of life, purushartha, goals of love, human life. Because Hindu organizational structure does not converge on a single center, Hindu scripture interpretation is not determined by one exclusively correct method. And the construction of Hindu religious ideas is not determined by universally affirmed body of incontrovertible dogma. Considerable differences in ideas and practices are generally accepted. Hindus tend to begin their life with the beliefs they have inherited and then retain them or adopt ones that better fit them. The many manifestations of divinity known to Hindus tend to be considered complementary to one another rather than inevitably in conflict with one another. Moreover, Hindus tend to distinguish themselves from other insiders within Hinduism as well as from non-Hindu outsiders on the basis of practice, orthopraxy, before belief, orthodoxy. And this tendency can diminish the disruptive potential of conceptual and doctrinal differences. Participation in some ritual activities and admission to some religious sites, however, are likely to be limited to specific categories of people on the basis of their heritage, initiation, or religious preparation. With this background in mind, let me move to peace building in Hinduism. Now, it is true that the literature of Hinduism does not instruct at much length about systematic peace building, as can also be seen by the very fact that not a single work on Hinduism contains indexed references to peace building, peacemaking, reconciliation, or forgiveness. Yet they extol the social and spiritual values of non-violence, ahimsa, non-anger, forgiveness, peace, friendship, and compassion to beings, all building blocks of conflict resolution. What I'll do, I'll survey a few texts and on peace building, and let's start with the Vedas. Now, Rig Veda 1.164.46 highlights the spirit of religious pluralism, toleration and diversity, affirms the validity of all religions as engaged in pursuit of a common goal, namely the seeking and experiencing of the one reality. The hymn reads, "The seers call in many ways that which is one." This statement is echoed in Rig Veda 10.114.5. Him with fair wings, the only one in nature, wise singer's shape, with songs in many figures. Rig Veda 10.191.4 concludes with a prayer for harmony and peace by a union of hearts and oneness of spirit. Harmony implies the recognition and respect for the other. It is not an imposed unity or uniformity. It upholds the individuality of the other with whom one lives in concord. Atharved 12.1.45 reads, "May the earth that bears different people speaking varied languages with various religious rites according to the places of abode enrich me with a wealth of understanding in 1,000 ways, like milch cow that never fails." This hymn highlights the theme of humanity and diversity, consisting of people speaking different languages and residing in different places. It recognizes that the earth does not belong to one race, but to all humankind. Atharved 7.52.1 recites the sorrow over a war and a desire for reconciliation with strangers. It reads, "Let us have peace with our own people and peace with people who are strangers to us. The divine twins create between us and the strangers a unity of hearts. May we unite in our minds, unite in our purposes, and not fight against the divine spirit within us. Let not the battle cry arise among the slain, nor the arrows of the war god fall with the break of the day." In Yajurved 36.17, the word peace or shanti occurs a dozen times. May there be peace in celestial regions. May there be peace on earth. May the waters be appeasing. May herbs be wholesome. May trees and plants bring peace to all. May all beings bring peace to us. May religion propagate peace all throughout the world. May all things be a source of peace to us. May thy peace itself bestow peace on all. And may that peace come to me also. Peace, peace, peace. The verse that follows, 36.18, expresses the theme of friendship among every being in the world. It points to the universal oneness of all beings and the fellowship that we share. It reads, "May all beings look on me with the eye of a friend. May I look on all beings with the eye of a friend. May we look on one another with the eye of a friend." And this notion of one humankind is often stressed in the Hindu creation stories as well, in the Puranas as well. Kat Upanishad opens with a prayer for unity and peace. It says, "May he protect us both. May he take pleasure in us both. May we show courage together. May spiritual knowledge shine before us. May we never hate one another. May peace and peace and peace be everywhere." Now in this verse, there is the preference for we and us over I and me. The philosophy of identity based on the notion of an all-pervasive reality, Brahman, is the core of the Upanishadic teachings. From the theological perspectives of the Upanishads, the notion of oneness or unity of all life forms is the ultimate and final truth. Chandogya Upanishad 3.14.1 says, "The whole world is Brahman." The famous Upanishadic statement in Chandogya Upanishad 6.8.7, "That thou art," not only establishes the identity between the individual self, Atman, and the absolute Brahman, but also indicates that everything that exists is an aspect or expression of Brahman. Hence, any sense of discrimination among the created beings is reflective of the state of ignorance. And ignorance is one cause of conflict. Pride and greed are other causes of conflict. And these are tackled in Kan Upanishad and Kat Upanishad. Kan Upanishad says, for instance, "The man who claims he knows nothing. But he who claims nothing knows." While greed is addressed in Kat Upanishad, says, "The good is one, the pleasant another." In another Upanishad passage, it inspires to seek peace from conflict. It says, "Lead me from the unreal to the real. Lead me from darkness to light. Lead me from death to immortality. Peace, peace, peace unto all." Moreover, almost every hymn and prayer in the Upanishads ends with Om Shanti, said three times, translated as peace, 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 peace. Of course, one could say that it is the inner peace that is being invoked. But peace starts with oneself, doesn't it? Yajurved 40.6 refers to forgiveness, compassion, and service as key values. And I quote in length. It says, behave with others as you would with yourself. Look upon all the living beings as your close friends. For in all of them, there resides one soul. All are but a part of that universal soul. A person who believes that all are his soulmates and loves them all alike never feels lonely. The divine qualities of forgiveness, compassion, and service will make him lovable in the eyes of all. He will experience intense joy throughout his life. Similarly, while the Mahabharata is primarily dominated by examples of the horrors of war and revenge, within the text there remains a message about the value of forgiveness. Perhaps no call for peace is more striking than the one which the Mahabharata conveys on behalf of an old woman whose son has been killed. After she is informed that killing an enemy brings merit, the grieving mother replies, forgiving an enemy brings greater merit. In another passage, when Gandhari laments the death of her sons, Rishi Vyas tells her daughter-in-law, this is the time for forgiveness, cost of anger, Gandhari, cultivate the art of peace. Yet in another dialogue, when Draupadi, who had been dishonored by the Kauravas, tried to persuade Yudhishthir to revenge on his cousins, he replied, if there were not persons in this world who exercised forgiveness, then chaos would soon prevail. If kings and other superiors give way to anger, then the distressed people would quickly meet with ruin. If inferiors do not tolerate their superiors' admonishments, then sin will take root and destroy mankind. I shall cite to you the verse spoken in ancient times by Rishi Kashyap. Forgiveness is virtue. Forgiveness is sacrifice. Forgiveness is the Vedas. Forgiveness is purity and penance. It is truth, religion, holiness. Through forgiveness, the universe is sustained. And by practicing forgiveness, a man can attain to everlasting regions of bliss. And then Yudhishthir concludes, how then can I renounce forgiveness, O Draupadi, in which is established truth and wisdom in the three worlds? Therefore, forgiveness is considered the highest virtue. Another episode of forgiveness comes from the Ramayana, when Hanuman, after the death of Ravan, seeks to massacre Ravan's supporters. Sita replies, no, they were only obeying the king's orders. She cites the famous response of the bear to the tiger. You should not retaliate when another does you injury, even if those who do wrong deserve to be killed. The noble ones should be compassionate, since there is no one who does not transgress. And these last words, who does not transgress, constitute a rich reconciling weapon. The Mahabharata also accords the highest good to nonviolence. It says, for instance, in 11.12.13.14, nonviolence towards all beings is the highest duty. Nonviolence, speaking truth, and forgiveness are definitely more important than adherence to Vedas. Elsewhere it says, victory through a war is deplorable if it could be achieved without a war. Nothing is greater than a victory gained through dharma. It further declares, victory creates enmity. The defeated is engrossed in suffering. Having kept himself aloof from victory and defeat, the peaceable person sleeps undisturbed. The Mahabharata also brings out the negative ramifications of war. It says in 26.1, no war is better than waging war. A person by knowledge may have no truck with war. And the logic continues. Or else, it says in 70.53, war is thorough and thorough distress. Who remains unhurt while hurting others? The Mahabharata also exemplifies the principle of last resort. As the Pandavas wait 13 years in exile before avenging themselves. As the war approaches, a wise man advises the Kauravas not to fight, asking, what man is so cursed by fate that he would undertake with war what can be accomplished by conciliation? Similarly, the narrator repeats this refrain later. What is more frivolous than going to war? Why would a man knowingly go to war? Who cursed by his fate would choose war? Mahabharata praises the Pandavas because they desire peace and do not want war. The envoy for the Pandavas declare, if without hurting the cause of the Pandavas, I succeed in bringing peace to the Kurus, it will be a deed of high merit and import, and they will be saved from the noose of death. Rishi Vyas likewise warns, victory is uncertain, it depends on chance. Even they that become victorious have to sustain loss. Even Kautilya's Arthashastra cautions that even when the advantages of peace and war are equal, one should prefer peace. For war causes loss of power and wealth and is troublesome and sinful. Similarly, Niti Sar also warns that warfare always results in loss for a monarch and his subjects. So it is better to make peace even with concessions, but recommends that where in war victory is doubtful, in that case peace should be concluded. Again and again in Mahabharata and across numerous texts, it is repeated that war should be avoided if possible. It is no wonder Mahatma Gandhi finds the futility of violence as the core message of the Mahabharata. So finally, as my last example, let me briefly look at Gandhi's interpretation of the Bhagavad Gita, which is the Hindu's key to achieving peace. The most important lesson which Gandhi draws from the Gita is his concept of non-violence, or ahimsa. He does not say that it teaches non-violence directly, but that non-violence is the consequence of its teaching. Gandhi observes, and I quote, I do not believe that the Gita teaches violence for doing good. It is preeminently a description of the duel that goes on in our hearts. The divine author has used an historical incident for inculcating the lessons of doing one's own duty even at the peril of one's life. And it inculcates performance of duty irrespective of the consequences. For we mortals, limited by our physical frames, are incapable of controlling actions, save our own. And then he goes on. He says, I do not agree that the Gita advocates and teaches violence in any part of it. See the concluding chapter at the end of chapter 2. Although that chapter lends itself to a violent interpretation, the concluding verses seem to me to preclude any such interpretation. The fact is that a literal interpretation of the Gita lands one in a sea of contradictions. The letter truly killeth, the spirit giveth life. That is, strict observance of the letter of the law is far less important than being true to its spirit. And this he said in 1925. Now, Krishna was not discussing the question of violence and non-violence. Arjuna was not adverse to killing in general, but only to killing his own relatives. Hence, Krishna advised that one should do one's duty without consideration of one's relations. The real theme of the Gita is self-realization and its means. That is, renunciation of the fruit of action. Now, the fight between the two armies is only an occasion to expound the theme. If it is difficult to reconcile certain verses with the teaching of non-violence, it is, Gandhi states, far more difficult to set the whole of the Gita in the framework of violence. Violence is impossible without anger, without attachment, without hatred. And the Gita tries to carry us beyond the state of sattva, rajas and tamas, state that excludes anger, attachment and hatred. Again, the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, instead of teaching the rules of physical warfare, tells us how a perfect man is to be known. In the characteristic of the perfect man of the Gita, there is nothing that corresponds to physical warfare. Its whole design is inconsistent with the rules of conduct governing the relations between warring parties. Now, in chapter 2, Gandhi makes an interesting note to verse 2.18, which states, bodies are known to end, but the soul that is embodied is eternal, indestructible. Therefore, Arjun, fight the battle. Now, this is what Gandhi argues. If you argue that since all bodies are perishable, one may kill, does it follow that I may kill all the women and children in the ashram? Would I have in doing so acted according to the teaching of the Bhagavad Gita, merely because their bodies are perishable? What then shall we say of a person who mouths these seemingly learned arguments and then commits wickedness? To know the answer to this, we should go back to the first chapter, he says. Arjun had said that he did not want even the kingdom of gods if he had to kill his kith and kin for that. But he's bound in any case to kill them, for he has accepted the dharma which requires him to kill. This verse 2.18, with the word yudh yasva applies to him. But it does not apply to others. In this verse, Sri Krishna wants to free Arjun from his ignorant attachment. Now, this brief survey of selected passages, different texts, confirms the existence of a stream of a Hindu tradition that can assist peace building. It reveals that Hinduism has the potential to address the needs of a global society. Human life will be governed by dharma. Hindu traditions concerned with order, with dharma, underpins its perspectives on the ethics of peace and war across the spectrum. I repeat this. Hindu traditions concerned with order, with dharma, underpins its perspectives on the ethics of peace and war across the spectrum. Dharma is a pivotal concept around which Hinduism's self-understanding revolves. Its meanings and uses exemplify not only what Hinduism is, its identity, but also explain the traditions, tensions, changes, reinterpretations, and diversity. Further, there is an elastic coherence in the term that reflects the elusive yet undeniable coherence of Hinduism itself. Dharma is what holds together. And thus it is the basis of all order, whether natural, cosmic, social or moral. Hence, perhaps because of this, that the literature is silent about peacemaking. I'll come to this later in our perhaps discussion. It is the power that makes things what they are. It is the power that makes things what they are. The idea contains the implication that what a Hindu does is more important than what a Hindu believes. Thus, by means of dharmic actions, Hindu culture sought to create, reinvigorate, nourish and maintain cosmic order. Eventually, with the development of classical Hinduism, not just specific rituals, but every human action was said to contribute to the maintenance of cosmic and social order. Dharma, when adhered to, was expected to yield a long, robust life full of happiness and blessings and peace. Dharma, when adhered to, was expected to lead a long, robust life full of happiness and peace. Hence, we don't need to talk about peace. And hence, Hinduism does not, like other religious traditions do. Overtly, they go out of their way to talk about peace. A major implication of dharma is that the ideal human society is fundamentally hierarchical. Everyone has a place and things. Everyone has a place. Things do not just happen. They happen justly. People differ from one another, and these differences are both distinctive and defining. People have different aptitudes, predilections, and abilities. In regard to social position, they are carefully circumscribed castes or classes, varna dharma, characterized by particular social functions that generate a horizontal view of society. In addition, there are stages of life, ashram dharma, that support one's personal development vis-a-vis one's vertical ascent toward liberation from the cycle of births, death, and rebirths, or samsara. And this is, of course, varna ashram dharma. There is also swadharma, one's own duty, apad dharma, law in circumstances of calamity, yug dharma, law in the context of a particular epoch or time period, and sadharana dharma, which means general obligations. All of these various dharmas acknowledge and address the fact humans have different abilities and aptitudes and responsibilities, and thus dharma specifies a variety of ways of being, of spiritual paths and of worldviews, each of which is in itself a valid way, to foster the eventual fulfillment of an appropriately human religious destiny. For the ordinary Hindu, the main aims of worldly life require conforming to social and ritual duties and to traditional rules of conduct for one's caste, family, and profession. Such requirements constitute an individual's dharma, one's own part in the broader order and fundamental equilibrium in society, nature, and the cosmos. As such, dharma involves the ongoing maintenance of the social and cosmic order. And until quite recently, it was assumed that dharma could be protected or violated only by Hindus because they are subject by birth to its provisions. Those outside the one ashram dharma system, and thus non-Hindus, had neither the obligation nor the right to uphold it. Which, of course, is not true, as I said. So I've left the conclusion open-ended. Why is Hinduism silent? On peace building, why is there not a systematic discussion about peace building in Hinduism as in other tradition, religious traditions? It's because of dharma maintains that cosmic order. If each one of us fulfills one's dharma appropriately, properly, ethically, righteously, then there will be peace. The order will be maintained. Yes? Mm-hmm. Make sense? Not the lecture, but the idea. But the idea. I'm not a theoretical person. I theorize, of course. But I try to make Hinduism practical for my undergraduates. I teach in an undergraduate institution. And for me, if one cannot see Hinduism as... For me, I see Hinduism as practical. If it's not, then it's not part of Hinduism, period. You know, there is a lot of criticism. I my field is also Gandhi studies. For the last 10 years, I've been in Gandhi studies. So I've done a lot of work on Gandhi. Not necessarily Hinduism peace building. This is my first attempt, actually. But Gandhi. And a lot of criticism. Lot of criticism in the field that Hinduism is silent about peace building. Then they cite Mahabharata and Bhagavad Gita. Look, even Krishna is saying, fight, fight, fight. But they forget this concept. Dharma. Dharma makes it. At the end, it makes everything all right. You know, I was just... this is the quote I found in... I usually don't watch English films. Perhaps I watched 2 English films in my entire life. And this, there was a free channel. You know, we have satellite. So, satellite channels. And we get our Hindi programs. But they were giving this free movie channels. They were showing Marigold. So I said, on India. So there is a passage in it, last 5 minutes. It says, everything will be all right in the end. And so if it is not all right, it is not the end. That's Hinduism. That says everything. That says... So this has... The cycle has to go through. Peace building is not just, you know, there is no violence. It's part of that cycle. It's part of that cycle. It's part of that samsara. For me, I take Vishnu. Yes, as a Hindu, I may believe in Lord Vishnu. And I do. But that as a Hindu, as an academic, I don't see it in that way. I see it as a practical cycle. Everything is born, then sustained, and there is that, and everything has to come to an end. And after that end, something new comes out. It's practical. You know, Vishnu, Shiva, Brahma, the creator, Vishnu, the preserver, and Shiva, the destroyer. As a Hindu, yes, I literally believe that at home. But outside of home, for me, it's a practical statement that there is birth of everything. This pen was born. It's being sustained and it will eventually die. I'll throw it away out of that destruction. And sometimes war is necessary. That's what Mahabharata is all about, from my perspective. As a practical, in a practical way. That it's necessary so that something new, better, is reborn. You know, scholars spent the last 300 years we have been doing Hindu studies. Translating all that. That's good. We need to maintain all that. But we need to look at all these things at a practical level.
Thank you, Professor Mitchell. That's very, very interesting and stimulating. It's been stimulating my thoughts. There's a lot of discussion in Oxford on the notion of a just war. Nigel Biggers just published his big book
on it. Yes.
So is there a notion of a just war in Hinduism?
Yeah, actually Bhagavad Gita, Mahabharata, it all talks about just war. I was going to address that. I chose not to. But yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And perhaps that's... I'm relating that indirectly with that cycle. Just war. You need to use violence at times to bring about a better society.
That would be a Gandhian position, though, wouldn't it?
It would even be a Gandhian position. Even Gandhi said that. Hesitatingly, I have a... But I shouldn't have removed those. When I was editing this article just last night, I removed several passages. Even Gandhi admitted to that. Someone, somewhere. Don't have that question. Even Gandhi admitted to it. See, there is no really true form of non-violence. I think it's a myth. Even Gandhi, from my perspective, and I'm a fellow, I consider myself to be a fellow traveler with Gandhi, a Gandhian in my personal life. But I believe that Gandhi was a very violent person. In his non-violence, his words, they were very harsh. His actions, they were very harsh, not only towards his own body, but towards his family members, towards others in his ashram. So to say that we can have a pure form of non-violent society, I think it's a myth. When I started the Mahatma Gandhi Center for Global Non-Violence at James Madison University, trained it for 5 years, people didn't understand why we were saying that we want a better organized and a more and a less violent society. Better organized, I didn't use the word dharmic, because otherwise you are putting walls between yourself and the community members. So a better organized, a more dharmic, in other words, society, but less violent society. Usually those who work in the field of peace studies, they say, we want to eradicate violence. Come on, get a life. Sorry. But let's be practical. No, because it's very... I have been in this field for the last 20 years. It's very irritating. Because it seems we have accomplished nothing. You know? Except... Let me not. I get very irritated. We publish and publish and publish and publish. And we go to our classes and stand and give lectures. But we don't make it practical. How can you have a perfect non-violent society? Or a perfect dharmic society? It's impossible. But peace, those who are in the peace studies, and Gandhian studies, they want to eradicate violence. No. Better organized and a less violent. Because one has to. Violence is part of non-violence. Even Mahabharat, to achieve a better organized and a less violent one, they had to do this. They waited. You know, they waited 13 years. And then eventually they said, well, it's time. Now we need to get rid of these quarrels.
So peace here isn't an absolute state. It's a state of less violence.
Of less violence. But my point here is that Hinduism is criticized for lack of a systematic theory on peace building. But if you look at these passages here and there from the Vedas, Upanishads, Puranas, Bhagavad Gita, the epics, Mahabharata, Ramayana, you do find this. And someone needs to theorize these and make it systematic. Just like Gandhian views, he was not a systematic scholar. His views are, you know, in 1921 he said something, that's what I did when I read those couple of passages. They were from 1921, 1925, 1931. And then you put them together and said, this is the Gandhian theory of this. Similarly with Hindu. And that was my point, that you know, if they do talk about it, it's not that they are not concerned about peace. Hindus are not concerned. They are concerned about peace and non-violence. And it's not just Gandhi. You know, it's usually Gandhi. No, go back to the tradition. There is so much. I mean, it's full of these ideas, but not yet systemized. And this semester I'm on sabbatical, and one of my aims is to do this. So this was my first attempt. Yes. Your name, please?
Vid.
Vid.
So I had a question. You're talking about the idea of dharma probably precluding additional or systemized idea of peace building. What about some kind of orthopraxical dimension, such as the idea of seva, which is what I look at?
Yes, service.
And so what would you think about that as perhaps an action of this idea of dharma? And then what would someone that says there is no theory of peace building in Hinduism think of that? Because Hindu groups are performing seva. They're performing service of not just Hindus, but people across the world. And yeah. So how would that...
Seva is part of peace building.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes,
but
exactly.
What would an opponent of Hinduism having in this concept of peace building have to say about that?
I'm not actually... The last
you
part...
You were referring to a number of scholars saying there's no theoretical backing for
yes.
peace building. And so what would they think of seva being?
Oh, okay. I see. let me... You said this, actually. I'm going to use Professor Flood's expression on for something else. They are crazy Hindus. Really. Let's be practical. Whatever, it's very difficult to academia is already very biased towards the field. Being in this field of Gandhian studies, they don't understand. When we talk about dharma will make everything right. No. But seriously, seva, I think they may understand, because in Christianity, there's service is the utmost. Seva is valued in Christianity, in the Judeo-Christian tradition, specifically Christianity. So they may understand that. But I need to think more about that, though. I think they may understand that. Let me just write that down, actually. There is a Robinson here somewhere in UK. He has written several articles on seva among Gujaratis here, but hasn't related that to peace. I'm here for another few weeks. Actually, let me think more about this, and then hopefully we'll have a discussion here.
Sure.
Huh? Yes.
Just a follow-up on you just mentioned, I'm sure it's humorously, but you mentioned crazy Hindus, and just on following up from you started by giving your lecture by giving us an imagery of different practices.
Yes.
And you mentioned interpretation, subjective, etc.
Yes.
Like
yes.
What I practice as a Hindu
yes.
is different
yes.
from
yes.
what someone else
yep.
would
yep.
practice. So in that sense, Hinduism is interpreted by different people in different ways.
Yes.
That is how you...
There is not one thing that a Hindu says that is not denied.
Yeah, that's
another.
Right. Yeah, and then we went on to literature as some sort of a unified literature where it is telling us exactly what to do. And then you're now talking about dharma in the sense of almost, it seems to imply everybody knows what their own swadharma or
swadharma.
Whatever they are supposed to follow. Whereas, what if they interpret it differently?
Yeah.
For example, practically, if you look
yeah.
at, for example, the caste system, now the untouchables are breaking out.
Yeah.
And so would we say that they are not following Hindu teachings anymore, or they are
yeah.
following their,
yeah.
in the process of the... a cycle of dharma, are they now following what actually is their dharma, or are
yeah.
they going against what should be their dharma? In that
yeah.
sense, how is Hinduism as an orthopraxy tradition related to text or
yeah.
Literature in
yeah. Again, practically speaking, if I may give my own example, you know, I've never read the Vedas as a Hindu. I, as a practicing Hindu, all that I've learned that through watching Hindi films, really, watching cartoons on Krishna and Ganesh. No, seriously. And not by reading these books. Never. I'm 47 years old. I've never learned. It's all by watching these films, by discussing, you know, sitting together and doing the rituals at festivals, on Diwali, asking questions. My own children, 13 and 12 and 14, I have never once taught them about anything about Hinduism. Anything. And they are at a place where there are hundreds of books on Hinduism. You know, that's what I do. But never once. How do they learn their Hinduism? It's through watching films, cartoons, festivals. You know, films on Mahabharata, Bhagavad Gita. So, yes, it's a theoretical exercise. Yeah? This what, you know, this trying to put together this systematic notion of peace building, it's a theoretical exercise. Hindus don't read the Mahabharata, the Ramayana, the Vedas, the Upanishads. They don't learn about Hinduism from the textual tradition. So this is a theoretical exercise, and it's an interpretation, definitely. Have I answered your
question? No, that's fine. Yeah.
The question of the vision of peace in Hinduism. Is this discourse on peace not absent from Hinduism because of its concentration on self, individualistic attitude that is present in Hinduism, but as well in some other religions? So there are a lot of discourses on social matters, yes, caste, ashrama, and so on, but somehow the discourse is built from beginning from individual.
True,
that's
very
your
true.
Dharma.
Yep.
That's why you stay in this ashram.
Yep.
You told that how many Hindus, so many Hinduisms. Is it not because of this individualistic pattern, and then we have social questions coming from outside the tradition, and we need to find an answer because people ask us.
Yeah.
So
Actually, we
put ourselves questions that are not coming from from.
You
our
just
tradition.
Said it, I think.
First aspect, and the second aspect, your quote from this film: "The end will be fine. If
everything
it's
will
not
be
fine,
right.
It's not the end."
Yes.
So. And you said it is Hinduism. Okay. If I believe this.
Believe this quote?
Yes.
Okay.
And if I say, okay, there is no peace because it's not end. The end.
Yeah. Because if there is
somehow,
peace, then it's the end.
The end is somehow as a subject in our game. So. The peace is brought not by ourselves, not created by ourselves. We are doing Dharma. But the peace as end, as subject, will come by his own forces and bring us peace. So we don't need to worry.
Yep.
Because the end is not here, everything fine, but it will come.
Exactly.
So we are passive waiting.
It's not necessarily passive, because you are performing your Dharma. And dharma is not passive, it's active, it's life-affirming. It's a positive force. I repeat, it's active, life-affirming, positive force. It's not passive.
Yes, but peace has to do with individuals, because but you can say I have no peace inside of me, but it's like a metaphor.
Yes.
Usually peace is absence of... But we can have
but
all
what is
possible
peace?
Different...
Yes.
this is a conflict between two forces, two individuals, two societies, two views. So, but it involves something, a kind of externalization, if you want.
So your question is, because I'm that's why I'm agreeing with you, with your first comment, that it's an individualistic religious tradition. And then that dharma will make it all right, as long as we perform, each one of us performs one's dharma, as I said earlier, righteously, ethically, properly, everything will be all right. And if one doesn't, then there is disbalance. If the if I may use these terms, if the untouchables do not perform their duty rightly, ethically, morally, then there will be chaos in society. If there is chaos in society, it's because we are not fulfilling our respective dharms properly.
Yes, but
this is very important to understand at a practical level. If all of us fulfilled their respective dharms properly, ethically, morally, righteously, then there will be.
As a colleague of mine said, and you as well, as many Hindus, so many Hinduism.
Yes.
If we want to have order and peace, we need to have one dharma for everybody accepted by everybody.
Not necessarily. Not necessarily. Because if there is only one dharma, no, that's what I mean.
If everybody can have his own...
But my dharma is different than yours, based on not my age, my caste, my class, my education, my background, my economic background, my varna, ashram, dharma, and all that. Our dharma cannot be the same. There are different dharmas for not only different people, for each person, okay, but also different dharmas at different ages.
Inside the same pattern, if you want. So we are playing chess.
Yeah.
Everybody is playing his own game, but the general table is the same.
Yes.
But if we say that Hinduism permits ourselves to understand and reinterpret in our own way, I will be playing chess and Anthony will be playing cards, and it doesn't work.
Yeah, but when you are playing chess, you are playing chess.
Yeah, but he has his own vision of chess, which is cards.
At a theoretical level, you are right, but that's not practical. When I'm in class, my students are there, sitting. You know, there is some kind of order. That's important. That situation is important. If you're playing, if there has to be that kind of order. My students can't, you know, I'm a very strict professor. I'm very strict. I kick out my students if there isn't that order. However, I have no idea what I'll be talking in my classes. I don't read. This is unusual because I'm giving formal lecture. I never read. I go there and I have no idea what I'll be talking about. I close my eyes. No, this is and I'm not exaggerating or lying at all. I close my eyes and I said, okay, last week I said this. Now, okay. And then I go. And it all comes together. There's chaos. But it all comes together at the end. And I've been doing this for the last 16 years. But it's chaos. My teaching is chaotic. But there is order in that chaos. I gave 23 writing assignments in my Hinduism class. It's chaos. It's chaotic. But there is order. There is order in that chaos. And that, I think, is very important to understand. If we understand, then all this is very clear. There is order in that chaos. But chaos is necessary. Chaos is necessary. That, I think, we need to understand. Perhaps we can go a step further and say violence is necessary. violence is perhaps necessary to bring about a better organized and a less violent world. Otherwise, this cycle doesn't make sense. This samsara cycle, at a practical level, for me, not only as an Hindu intellectual, or sorry, I shouldn't have said that, as an intellectual, but also as a Hindu. I don't consider myself as a Hindu intellectual. You know, perhaps that's what this center is doing, creating Hindu intellectuals. There is a difference. So, but I think what I'm saying is very important. There is order in that chaos. There is order in that chaos. Do you think otherwise I would have peace? You know, my life will be chaotic. It's not chaotic. There is order in my life. There is order in my teaching. In that chaos, I'm not organized at all. At all. I was looking at Professor Gavin keeps a diary of, you know, on Friday he will do this, Thursday, this. Everyone else, everyone, you also, like all of you. And there is chaos. I forget half of my appointments. My wife reminds me, who is sitting outside. But there is order. I have my wife to remind me. You know, she's my order in this case, in this particular. My students tell me, my TAs tell me, teaching assistants, okay, paper is due on such and such and this and that. They create that order for me. But there is order.
I thought that was very ordered. I didn't think that was chaotic at all.
Yes, because it's a formal talk. Otherwise, yeah. I don't.